Welcome, everyone, to our ad hoc Kindness Matters seminar this week. So today we'll have David Moss talking about temperature enhancement of thermal Hall conductance quantization. So just very brief intro. David got his PhD from MIT in 2013, right? Yeah. So back then we shared office for 2 years. And then he moved to Caltech for a postdoc and has been in Weizmann as a faculty member there for actually how many years? 4 years?
It's 4 years now, yeah.
4 years, yes. So yeah, David, it's your turn.
All right, thanks. Thanks, Zhang, for inviting me to talk here about the recent work. So I want to talk about something that I was doing fairly recently with Cosma. Was at Weizmann, at Leipzig, and my colleagues from Weizmann, Yuval Orek, Adi Stern, as well as Sasha Mirlin from Karlsruhe. So this is a question which arose out of previous work thinking about quantum Hall states and specifically about quantum Hall systems at nucleus 5-half. But Zhang asked me to be a somewhat, give a generous introduction. So I'll start a little bit basic and remind you about some things about the quantum Hall effect that will be relevant for the story later on. So the classical Hall effect is something which I don't need to use many words over. We have electrons, they perform orbits in the magnetic field. So quantum mechanically, we know that we instead get discrete energy levels like so. And the degeneracy is such that we have one electronic state per flux quantum in such a system. So when we put our chemical potential at some point, as indicated here by this dashed line, we get, we fill exactly all those states down here, and we leave all the other states empty. So we have a gap state. And what's maybe more interesting is what happens when we put these states into a finite system. So we have some confining potential, which ensures that our electrons don't leave our system. So it's indicated here by these lines diverging at our sample boundaries, which it follows then that the energy levels will necessarily cross the chemical potential, and that gives us our edge states, which are protected, and specifically they are unidirectional. So they may maybe all move upwards on the right-hand edge and downwards on the left-hand edge. So if I'm taking my system and I'm putting a bias voltage across, here I have a now different chemical potential on the right-hand side and the left-hand side, then I have more particles flowing upwards and flowing downwards, or equivalently saying I'm having a total current that flows upwards to my system perpendicular to the applied voltage. So this means that we would have a Hall conductance which changes and jumps as a function of a chemical potential whenever we cross one exactly filled level of these electrons. That's pretty much all we need from the clean case, and it's pretty simple. And now if we increase the temperature of the system, we would generically expect that all these steps will wash out, they'll be smooth. And just dimensionally, we can understand that if we increase temperature, then even though the chemical potential is inside the gap, we will start to populating additional states. So we'll have some amount of carriers which can conduct current, in this case, in the transfer, like in the direction from left to right, and thereby relax the current flowing upwards. So we will lose this perfect quantization and we get something of the sort, which is of course pretty sensible and what one would expect. I have some quantum mechanical feature, and at finite temperature, I'm starting to lose these nice features. Okay, so the more interesting thing is maybe what happens when I'm actually disordering the system. So here I'm just depicting some sample with disorder. And in that case, one starts thinking about what happens to the conductance of my system. Does my system conduct, or is it the system an insulator? And that one is conveniently phrased, that question, in terms of the scaling of the conductance. So I'm asking, how does my conductance change as I make my system bigger and bigger as I scale it up? The first contribution is purely classical and follows from dimensional analysis. The conductance is the conductivity, which is some intrinsic quantity, times the cross-section divided by the length, And depending on the spatial dimension, this number here will either go up with system size, it will go down with system size if I blow everything up uniformly, or as it happens in two dimensions, it will be system size independent. So in two dimensions, this first term over here is absent in the conductance, which would suggest that it's actually independent of the system size if there wasn't quantum correction to this term. The quantum correction that which exists here is just what happens due to interference. So what one needs to ask is, if I have an electron starting at point A in my sample, so it can start bouncing around in some way, and it may, for example, after bouncing around a lot, return to point A, that's one possibility, or the other possibility is that it may bounce around and not come back and end up different places B. And so what we just compare is which of these probabilities are larger. Is there a larger probability for my particle to return where it came from? Then I would say that the system does not conduct, the particles kind of like to stay put, or is the probability larger to go somewhere else than the system would be conducting, because it's easy to bias the electrons to move into a different direction. So what we usually all know in fairly basic classes is that the behavior of this depends on the symmetries of my sample. For example, if I have time universal symmetry, I can have interference between traversing the same path in one direction and in the opposite direction. And this is a kind of path which we naturally cannot have if you want to go from A to B, only if we have closed paths. And if there's time universal symmetry, there'll be constructive interference between these things, and there is a higher probability of the particle to return home, return back to where it started. So that is known as weak localization, and it's phrased in terms of this formalism above as a beta function, which is just minus 1 over pi in these units. So it just means the conductance goes down as I scale up my system. So if you look at this equation here, you'd notice that the first term is, if it exists, the classical term is order g. The correction, the quantum correction, is order 1. And in principle, one can, of course, have higher corrections, which are 1 over g, 1 over g squared, and so on. So the inverse g is a small parameter in this RG. Or in other words, it's well controlled in the limit of a well-conducting system, of metallic system. That's what's called just weak localization. And of course, it's completely trivial to solve this RG equation, and one finds that the conductance is some bare value, and then it gets a correction which is just logarithmic in system size. And that's maybe all familiar. Now, of course, we care about quantum Hall systems where we don't have time universal symmetry. And then it's a little bit trickier because the simple cartoon picture no longer holds, but it still turns out that without time reversal symmetry, there's still a slight favoring to returning back home. But in this case, it is 1 over g, so it's one higher order in this inverse coupling constant. So you might call it very weak localization. It's, even though the standard terminology is just to call them weak no matter what. But it's clear that here it takes even longer for the conductance to actually become small. So that's the case for the system without time universal symmetry and disorder, which is the situation that we care about in the quantum Hall effect. And by the way, if there are any, I assume that this is very well known, but if there are any questions, just interrupt me whenever and I can try to address them. Okay, so that's, we now understand that generically, kind of no matter what we are doing pretty much, the system likes to localize, so it likes to form an insulating state. So the next thing that one should then ask is, are all these insulating states that it will form equivalent, or are there different states? And an easy way to get the answer is just to look into this nice periodic table over here. We have a system which has no symmetry whatsoever, so we just look at 0, 0, 0, we are in two dimensions, and it says that there are actually an infinite number of distinct phases characterized by some integer. And this integer is just the Hall conductance. I think there are, should I actually read the chat, or are people going to ask questions? This is a question to Chong maybe. Am I supposed to pay attention to the chat, or?
I can remind you that, but okay, in this case, it's simple enough that you can just, I guess, answer it right away. So what is chi symmetry? The question was.
Where's chi?
I think in your periodic table. Wait, Siri.
There's no chi here.
Yeah. Do you want to clarify the
capital psi, right? Like after time reversal, presumably it's time reversal something and parity.
This is time reversal. This is particle hole.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Sorry, I was supposed to, since I was just copying the well-known standard table, so I just assumed that the notation is universal. But maybe I should have clarified that. But regardless, we have no symmetries at all. So it's the simplest possible case, and so we're up here. Okay. So we have an integer number of an infinite number of possible insulators, characterized by it turns out by the Hall conductance, which takes integer values in natural units. So even though the generic behavior is that we localize, there must be specific cases, isolated points where we have topological phase transitions between these two, where we necessarily must delocalize. So if I'm looking at the localization length as a function of some parameter in my system that drives me across such a phase transition, it must diverge at some point. And then again at the next transition, and so on. And we expect that we get quantized Hall conductance so long as the system is large enough that we don't have longitudinal conductance, or in other words, when the system is larger than the localization length. And typically this is pretty well satisfied, simply because system size is a macroscopic scale and the localization length is kind of made up of microscopic things. So you have to really work hard to get into a case where the localization length is truly larger than system size. And it really only happens pretty much exactly at the phase transition. There's very little width of these transitions. So that's what we have, but this property holds pretty much independent of the energy. So if I'm just redoing this calculation at a slightly different chemical potential, slightly different energy, nothing much changes. There's next to no energy dependence to these statements. And that suggests, naively at least, some rather strange property, namely that the quantization of the Hall conductance should also be pretty much temperature independent. Because it doesn't matter if I'm having states at slightly different energies, at slightly higher temperature, just means that I'm mixing states at different energies. And if I'm using states both at lower ones from the chemical potential and higher ones, but since everything's anyway localized, one might at least naively conclude that the Hall plateaus should be temperature independent. And just because temperature doesn't affect my localization on the single particle level. Now this is maybe wrong, as one might easily think from kind of general reasoning, but to actually work it out, one can understand that the reason where this fails is if I have dephasing in my system. So dephasing is a property which I have whenever my particles interact and thereby exchange energy. So they can interact with each other or they can interact with phonons. But either way, they lose their phase information. And once I lose phase information, I can no longer interfere. And since interference was the reason why my localization length kept growing and got I got a finite localization length, or where the conductance kept decreasing, it follows that once I have dephasing as a mechanism, the conductance can remain finite and possibly even large. So as my system gets larger than whatever the length scale is that determines the dephasing of my particles, then it stops decreasing. Right. And interactions, they tend to be sensitive to temperature. That seems fairly natural. At zero energy, at zero temperature, I'm not going to have any interaction effects. But at higher temperatures, I'll have more and more. Think, for example, about phonons. And typically, these dephasing lengths will follow some kind of power law. Density of states of phonons, something like that. You think about it. Turns out getting the actual power is somewhat controversial and not always easy. But I think the consensus is that it is a power law of some sort. So that now gives us, that was unfortunately to be expected.
Yeah.
Yeah, I already mentioned that to Chong earlier, since it's already somewhat late here. We have a power-saving mechanism where if I don't move enough, the light will turn off after a certain time. So that might happen a few more times. So, yeah, so I was just about to say that the phasing length depends on temperature, and now we're getting a phase which conducts reasonably well whenever the localization length becomes larger than the dephasing length rather than the system size. And this gives us a mechanism how we again get smeared out plateaus and not perfectly sharp transitions. And so after this extra work of using both disorder and interactions, we get back to a similar kind of sensible result that we expect, namely that the sharp quantum mechanical plateaus at zero energy get smeared out by temperature.
A question?
Yes.
Just I want to make sure previously you said interactions with phonons will introduce some finite alpha. I want to make sure if electron-electron interactions will already make finite alpha.
Yes, they will also do that.
Mm-hmm.
Just the electron-electron interactions are pretty tricky actually to analyze carefully, because if electrons localize, you may wonder how much does these do they actually affect things? So that's a harder question. Whereas phonons are not going to be feeling the localization, so you'll always have them. So it's maybe somewhat easier to understand why you always have the phonons around. But both of them will contribute to the dephasing.
Uh-huh. But is the contribution of electron-electron interaction to alpha already well understood?
You know, people have theories. They don't necessarily agree with each other, and they don't necessarily agree with experiment. But there's a serious body of work about it. Since, you know, since it is not well settled, I will not quote a specific value. But there, mm-hmm. are, you know, there are review papers on this, which one can easily find, and you know,
uh-huh. I see.
Find different numbers.
Thanks.
Okay, so now this baggage, we can understand the quantum Hall effect. We understand that there are these plateaus that the temperature will generically smear these out, so there'll be some finite width of transitions. And the advantage of this maybe more cumbersome disorder picture is that it allows us to tune any parameter we like. So now in the disordered case, we can not only tune the chemical potential to go between different plateaus, but we can tune alternatively the density or the magnetic field, and it will get the same behavior. And that's in fact what's done in this experiment, is the magnetic field is used as a tuning parameter. This is so far all about the simple quantum Hall effect, which behaves as one might expect it to behave. But I want to talk about the thermal Hall effect right now. And for these integer phases, it's actually not very different. So if I have a free electron system, or you know, more or less free electron system, just enough interactions to get the phasing, for example, then the thermal Hall effect will be slaved to the normal, to the charge Hall effect. Will be specifically given by the same integer n, just with a different natural unit. So instead of e squared over h, we get this specific combination of a Boltzmann constant, a Planck's number, and a temperature. And okay, that's of course been known for a long time, but actually in electronic systems has only been measured just a couple of years back, and it follows this behavior. But this behavior is actually not only true for free electrons. It holds for interacting electrons, and it even holds when we have charge carriers, which, for example, carry fractional charges, like in the quantum Hall effect. So more specifically, any charge-carrying edge state can be fractional or integer, will always carry an integer thermal conductance precisly as a free thermal edge state. So that's been also known for, you can see it for more than two decades, but was only explicitly verified experimentally a couple of years back here at Weizmann in Motti-Heibloom's group. So that's still not quite what I want to talk about. I want to talk about specifically cases where the thermal Hall conductance can be half integer in natural units. And so pictorially, what we just need to do is we take our electronic edge state and just split it into two. You can have, the real part of the electron keeps moving up and the imaginary part moves to the left, something of the sort. And what this requires us to do is to introduce pairing or to break charge conservation. So that's the kind of term which I would need to split my electrons into the real imaginary parts, or alternatively to two Majorana fermions. And that's of course compatible with this general statement, because now once I include superconductivity into the game, my edge modes are no longer charge carrying, and now they are allowed to carry fractionals. In this specific case, they carry half of the terminal Hall conductance of the electrons. So each Majorana fermion carries one half in natural units of the terminal Hall conductance. Any questions so far? Okay. So in terms of our symmetry, now we're going from our quantum Hall system, which doesn't have any symmetries. If you don't have any symmetries and then we introduce superconductivity, then we actually gain a symmetry, which is the particle Hall symmetry over here. So we go from class A to class D. This time it was particle Hall symmetry, where we again have an integer number of an infinite number of possible phases. And this is what it looks like. So these are all topological superconductors. They have some number of edge states, Majorana edge states encircling the system. And the edge spectrum is just essentially a straight line for a very large system. So they're just linearly dispersing. And they all disperse in the same direction, which means they're absolutely stable. So there's nothing you can do just on the edge to actually lose these Majorana edge states. So likewise, when I'm, say, drilling a hole into my sample, I'm going to generate new edge states, which will encircle this hole over here. And I'll get this similar kind of dispersion, except that if the hole is small, then these states as a whole will be subject to finite size quantization. So I'll have some discrete states as written over here. And if I furthermore put a pi flux or a superconducting vortex, HC over 2E vortex into the hole, then I'm going to shift these energy states such that I will have one exactly at zero and the other one are away. So since I have these zero energy states, these should be zero energy Majorana modes, and I'm getting one of these Majorana modes, zero modes, for any edge state which I had initially. Right? All the states away from zero you can imagine as being gapped out due to just a finite size gap. So we have one Majorana per edge state. But of course, once we have Majorana modes without chirality just localized, then we are no longer protected generically from interacting and from gapping out. And so these number of these Majorana zero modes will only be stable mod two. So any two Majoranas can always gap each other out and get away from zero energy. So it's only the question is, do we have an even number or an odd number? So it follows that if I have an odd number of Majorans at the edge, I'll have a half odd integer terminal Hall conductance, and then I'll have these Majorana zero modes in my system. So that's why people are excited about the half integer terminal Hall conductance specifically, because it means that you have a phase which has these Majorana zero modes, which may be exciting for being non-abelian, for having certain braiding properties, and so on. So that's a qualitative difference between integer and half-odd integer terminal Hall conductance. So where can one hope to get this kind of property? Well, one would just be in topological superconductor, just plain and simple. Another one turns out is in fractional quantum Hall states. And the third one would be in quantum spin liquids, where you can have both emergent fermions with the same property. And maybe somewhat surprisingly, it's the latter two, namely the fractional quantum Hall effect and the quantum spin liquid, where this half integer terminal Hall conductance was actually observed some 2.5 years back. So firstly, in the nu equals five half quantum Hall state, again here at Weizmann, and secondly, in this material, alpha ruthenium chloride in Matsuda's lab. And so in both cases, there's this magic half integer, which suggests that they are non-abelian phases involved. So I'll be talking about the fractional quantum Hall state for now, if I already introduced it. So since we know about the integer, I'll go straight ahead and talk about the fractional case right now. Any questions before I do that? Okay. All right. So we are in the fractional quantum Hall regime. So specifically, I want to think about the situation where we had a half filling. So we have two flux quanta per electron. Or in other words, we have very kind of a twice as many possible single particle orbitals as we have particles, which means that we have many possible states to occupy the single particle orbitals, and we're going to need interactions to break this very large degeneracy and form a unique state. So the convenient and natural way to organize these phases is by introducing the notion of a composite fermion, which is just an electron with two flux quanta. That object is again a fermion, and specifically in this half-filled case, once I define this, I end up with having these new fermions, these composite fermions, which live in a background of zero magnetic field. So they're really just like a metal without any field. So they can form, for example, a metallic state. And that is indeed what happens at the filling factor 1/2 over here. You can see it, you know, that at this point, there are no plateaus in the Hall resistance, but instead it follows a straight line precisely as it does in the classical Hall effect in a conventional net. That's one possibility. That's not the one I want to talk about. And the other one appears in the half-filled second Landau level, okay, or filling factor 5/2, where here we do have a plateau, the plateau sitting here. It's much more pronounced naturally in more modern data. So there's a plateau which indicates that there is a gapped phase, and that one is naturally interpreted in terms of a superconductor of these composite fermions. So the two composite fermions just pair up and form a superconducting state. And that one, again, since I don't have any symmetries in the game, naturally brings me into the same symmetry class D as I was talking about before from topological superconductors. And so that's kind of a long way of saying why I'm getting an effective model in this class D in the fractional quantum Hall effect. But this also tells us that we have actually many possible phases that could in principle account for this 5/2 plateau. I mean, there's an infinite number of possible pairing channels for these composite fermions. So there's some of them which are deemed more important in reality, and many of them have names. There's a famous Mori Pfaffian, for example, which in that notation just corresponds to integer one, having one Majorana moving in a certain direction. And then there are other ones discussed more recently with the name PH Pfaffian, Andrei Pfaffian, and so on. So these names are not super important for what I'm going to talk about. It's just, you know, these are just different integers, different number of edge Majoranas for these topological superconductors. And the key point here is that all of these phases have the same Hall conductance, which makes it so difficult to figure out which one is actually realized in these experimental systems. But by contrast, the thermal Hall conductance, as we already understand, can distinguish between them. Since they all have charge modes, they always give us some boring integer. And then there's an extra contribution, which exactly counts how many Majoranas do we have in the game. So I don't know how much time I should overall allocate, how strict you're going to be. I think I'll just go slow, and if I'm running out or in danger of running out, then Chong will tell me and I'll...
Yeah, I'm not setting really any hard deadline. Of course, okay. People can leave at any point.
You know, since I'm the one for whom it's late, so I'm guessing that I have more incentive to wrap things up eventually.
Yes. So.
Okay, very good. So, yeah, so we need this experiment. And ideally, as theorists, we would like to think that this is the experiment we have. We have a sample. We have a way of driving a heat current in some direction. And we measure the temperature drop across it, which is the way, kind of the textbook way of thinking about thermal Hall effect. Unfortunately, that's not an experiment which apparently can be done just for practical reasons, and certainly not in the quantum Hall cases, just because the numbers is, you know, you're trying to measure a quantum which is quite small. So instead, what they do is a slightly more complicated setup. Let me just, or it looks complicated, at least at first glance, so let me just briefly explain that it's actually pretty simple and what's actually done. So what they do here is they take a number of copies of the same quantum Hall state. Here I have in this picture four of them, like 1, 2, 3, 4. And they're all connected to a piece of metal in the middle over here. And so they're all connected. And then with use just a single edge channel here, the labeled as I in to drive a current into the system. So it gets pushed in here, and then it can leave the system wherever it wants for any of these outgoing channels. So charge conservation just tells us what comes in must go out. That's one consideration. And we can make a similar considerations for the amount of power. So there's a power balance, there's kind of power coming in into the island there and power coming out. And depending on the balance, it will may heat up or it may not heat up. And to relate these two, we just use Joule heating. So the power is just I squared divided by conductance, which we know. And if I plug it in, we find the power balance gives us the incoming power, which we of course know, times one minus the number of channels. So if we happened to have just a single channel like here, then everything that came in would come out and nothing would happen. But generically, you can see that the power balance is positive. So there's going to be power dumped into the piece of metal in the middle, and it's going to heat up. That's what happens. And one can kind of control how much it heats up by adjusting how many channels we have. So it heats up, and the question is, does it keep heating, or does it have another way to get rid of the heat? And in this case, in the five halves case, there may be a way, namely if we have neutral channels that can conduct heat but not charge. So we have used up all the charge modes, but we still have the kind of neutral modes in the game, and they can transport out some heat. And we know exactly how much they can transport out because it's quantized. So so this power balance, how much is coming in, must be compensated by the heat flow out of these neutral nodes, which is just given by the simple number, 1/2 times FK, the number, like the conductance sitting at these guys, times N, the number of channels, times the temperature of the metal. And all I need to do now is to see, okay, if these numbers exactly cancel, then the temperature doesn't change. So one can measure this number K, the thermal conductance, by just measuring the temperature. So if you have a very good way of measuring the temperature of the metal, then you can infer the thermal conductance of these quantum Hall states. And that's what they do in practice. So they have a very clever way of using noise to measure the temperature very accurately, and by that, work out what the thermal Hall conductance actually was. Okay, so that's the experiment which they did, and this is what they find. So they find that the thermal Hall conductance, as extracted from such a measurement, is very close to the value 5/2. So here you can see this, its temperature. Here it's in the range between 2.5 and 3, and it's closest to the value 5/2. That's first observation, and you might want to check whether if you change the filling factor a little bit, do you get a dramatically different value or not? Or in other words, do you actually have a plateau, or do you just have an accidental value? And it looks like you get something which you could interpret as a plateau. So the number, the value of the thermal conductance doesn't change very much as I change the filling factor over this range. Of course, I don't have very much range to play with because the plateau is pretty tiny. If you take this as face value, then you infer that you get n equals minus 1, which is the value for one of these possible phases, which I mentioned, this pH fucking phase. So there's other pieces of evidence which people pointed out, which may also support this phase. But it turns out that people were doing numerics on these kind of states for a very long time, and they never found this state. They always found a different possibility. Namely, they found one of the other two guys, this Pfaffian state and the anti-Pfaffian state. And there's been a lot of work on this, which raised the question, well, who's right? But of course, they don't quite need to coincide because they're doing somewhat different things. Like in the experiment, firstly, you have a real system, you have disorder, you may have all kinds of issues, and you're not doing an honest-to-God thermal transport measurement, but you're actually doing this slightly different type of measurement. And numerics are doing what they're doing. You have a finite size, you're clean because that's all you can do, and then you find these things. So So just let's take the numerical values to be accurate right now. Let's try to believe the numerics. And then if the system is clean, we must, sorry about that. We must be in one of these two phases, either the Pfaffian phase or the anti-Pfaffian phase, which differ by the number of my runner modes. One has one going in one direction, and the other one has three in the opposite direction. So you can more easily.
Yeah, I want to ask a question about some previous thing.
Okay.
So in the experiment, how large is the something like the thermal radiation?
How much is what?
Thermal radiation.
Thermal radiation?
Yeah, because you balance the power, maybe some power is carried by some thermal radiation away from the system.
I don't think thermal radiation, I mean, phonons are presumably the more what you want to think about, but let me anyway address it. So doesn't it, unfortunately, you have this extra knob here, which is a number of channels. So it turns out that without changing the sample in any meaningful way, kind of close to over here, you can actually change the number of channels just by having some of the edge states running around in a circle and not carrying anything away. Right. So you might expect that anything that doesn't involve edge states will just be carried away independently of n, whereas anything that depends on n must be related to the number of edge states. And that's exactly what they do as a way to subtract out all possible contributions. Like phonons are presumably the most important one in this case. They just compare values at different n. They subtract kind of the what's common to them and just look at the difference. So is that right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, so that's interface between these two possible phases. We have four Majorana's living there, and presumably the transition between these two clean phases would be first order. But now, once we start to want to get closer to reality, we include this order. We generically expect that a first order transition will not stay first order and will become rounded off and become continuous due to this order. So it's convenient to forget about its first order nature altogether and just think about what the continuous phase transition between these two could look like. And the simplest natural one is just one of four Majorana fermions that all change their sign as I go from the one phase to the other. And if I do that, think about it spatially, if I have four Majorana fermions with a negative mass here and the mass turn positive, then every time when the mass hits zero, I get one-dimensional Majorana mode living at the interface between these two. But from this perspective, the phase transition is actually a multi-critical point, right? I have four Majoranas, four masses, which must go to zero exactly at the same point if I want to have a direct transition between these two phases. So one may expect that if there's this order in my system, it will, ruin this kind of fine-tuning and actually give us a number of intermediate phases where only a single Majorana fermion changes its mass. So then I would get, instead of only the values for Pfaffian and anti-Pfaffian, I would get all the ones in between, and in particular the one that the measurement experiment measures. That's one way, at least, how the presence of this order could in principle reconcile the experiment and this numerical findings that it should be either this phase down here or that phase over there. But the situation is slightly more complex and more interesting because we are now in the symmetry class D, in the superconducting symmetry class. So we can go back to ask what happens if my system is dirty, what happens to this order, and what happens to the beta function. And in this case, it turns out that there's again the possibility of interference, but it's not between one path and its time reverse path, but it's been between a path and its particle hole conjugate path, because that's the symmetry that we have. And one can work it out that it turns out that these two actually interfere in the opposite way, kind of destructively. So there's a pi phase shift between the particle-like path and the hole-like path. And as a consequence, the particle doesn't like to go back to where it started, it likes to go somewhere else, or the system delocalizes. differently put, the conductance actually gets larger when I make my system bigger. So the quantum correction is positive. And that one, so that means that there is a possibility of having a phase which is not at all localized, like a metallic phase, where the conductance is presumably large. So based on that, one would draw a phase diagram of the sort. Maybe there's some range where I have these localized phases, but eventually I may enter a phase where my conductance just is large and grows with system size. So this same type of phase diagram was worked out in parallel by Chung and his collaborators, and there's a somewhat related work by these guys as well. So one thing which you may notice when you look at these phase diagrams is they are not referring to any specific model, like they're just hand-drawn lines indicating the phases. And that's essentially because they just describe what are all the possible phases and phase transitions which are allowed on general principles and not in any specific microscopic model. So conversely, if I am interested in a microscopic model and I tune some parameter, I may not follow a straight line, but I'll perform some trajectory, like something like this. So that's one possibility. I perform some trajectory in this phase, and I'd get a sequence of plateaus. But I might as well do something else, like so. I might start in a localized phase, go into the metal, back into some localized phase, back into a metal, and back into a localized phase. In this case, I would expect I get a plateau, something which is not a plateau, plateau, not a plateau, and plateau again. Or I could even have something where I'm most of the time in this delocalized phase and I'm never actually in the plateau. At this gray region, the thermal metal phase where nothing is localized and apparently nothing quantized. And based on this one, would suspect that probably one of the first two possibilities should be realized simply because the experiment seems to find a plateau. Right? I have different values of the filling factor, and the Hall conductance doesn't change appreciably, which I might expect if I have a thermal metal. So that was, up to this point, pretty much an old story. And now what we wanted to ask ourselves is, how true is it actually? And specifically, what are the properties of the thermal metal? And can we really rule out that such a thermal metal exists? But naively would say, yes, we can rule it out because there's no plateau. But there's some very kind of special property about this particle hole symmetry which we rely on to get this thermal metal in the first place. And that is that it's a symmetry which only acts in a specific part of the spectrum, namely at zero energy. So it relates states at positive energy and negative energy. Right? So if I have now states which are not at zero energy, but at slightly different energies, I'll get a phase factor between particle states and Hall states because they're not the same. And so I can try to estimate how much phase do I pick up by going away from zero energy. It's just some time scale times the energy. And the typical time scale I can relate to a length scale just by using the fact that in this ordered system, I'm going to be diffusive. So the typical time will just be diffusion time, whatever the length scale of my trajectory is, divided by some diffusion constant. That sets me a length scale in an infinite system, or it sets me an energy scale in a finite size system, beyond which I'm picking up a phase of order one and thereby kill the interference between particles. So now I have a different mechanism of killing interference. In this case, I'm killing the constructive interference, not by interactions or anything fancy, but just by the fact that I'm going away from zero energy. And once I'm going away from zero energy, I no longer really have an environment which is symmetric around it. So I destroy this constructive interference. And so if I'm looking now at a finite system, I'll get some bandwidths of states which are delocalized, where I'm getting this thermal metal behavior, but all other states away from zero energy will actually be localized and be similar to the ones in the quantum Hall state. So that's the key difference of this specific superconducting symmetry class. You know, particle Hall symmetry, which we like, is really special only at zero energy. And so that means that we have an interesting situation depending on our order of limits. So we can imagine that we have a finite system at we fix the temperature, and then we make the system larger and larger. And so in that case, as I remind you, this energy window, this bandwidth, is 1 over system size squared, so it will become much smaller than temperature at some point, which means that most of the states which will be in this energy range between temperature and negative temperature, like these are the states which should be active in my transport, will actually be localized, right? I'm trying to transport heat to my system. I'm essentially making attempts to pass the system somewhere in this energy window. And most of the time I make such an attempt, I'll actually find only localized states. So I don't actually manage to push my heat current through my system. So in this case, I would get a heat conductance which actually vanishes. So even though I'm raising my temperature, I'm getting a decreasing thermal conductance just on this cartoon level. Or I could have the opposite case, that I make my system finite and make my temperature very, very small. Then I will always have all temperature active states will be in this window of delocalized states. And in that case, I'll get a metallic state, where the thermal Hall conductance divided by the thermal conductance, longitudinal conductance divided by temperature actually diverges. Right. So this is kind of opposite limits, depending on whether you take the thermodynamic limit by first making temperature large, or first making the system large, or first taking temperature to zero.
So David, let me make sure. So the classic result that for this thermal metal, the specific heat goes as T log T, that's the second regime?
That's this regime here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good, thanks.
And essentially, when you think about thermal metal, that you typically talk about behavior associated with this over here, where you actually are metallic. Whereas in the case where you make a system large, you would lose all aspects of thermal metallicity. So this is now completely surprising and opposite to what I told you in the beginning, right? So now we have a system where raising the temperature at a fixed system size actually decreases thermal conductance. And if the longitudinal thermal conductance decreases, we would expect that the quantization, if there is any, will actually improve. So we get sharper plateaus, which is somewhat counterintuitive. And okay, so we wanted to test it slightly more seriously than just on this cartoon level.
Actually, so, Derek, can I ask? So for the relevant system, let's say Kallimasznyi, can one estimate the numbers, like the diffusive constant and so on, so to see how the two numbers compare?
I mean, you need to have the diffusive constant for Majorana fermions, not for electrons. I'm not sure how I would do that.
I see. Okay, yeah. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so the zeroth order result is yes, this is indeed what we find. I will not explain right now what's in this plot. I'll explain it in a little bit, but just to look ahead, this kind of surprising reasoning that we get a sharpening of plateaus with raising temperature is indeed what we find numerically in a model system. So that's kind of nice. So let me now show you what the model system is and what we actually do to test this behavior. The model system is pretty simple. What we choose is just a honeycomb model of Majoranas. It's written down here. So I have Majorana hopping between nearest neighbor sites, and I have an additional hopping the next nearest neighbors. We might recognize this type of model as a Haldane honeycomb model, where you can have a quantum Hall-like state without net magnetic field. And so the spectrum is of course well known. If I don't have a second term, I have a graphene-like spectrum where I have two gapless Majorana cones in this case. And at any value of this parameter V2, I instead open up a gap and very quickly get this kind of nice insulating phase. And so then the next question one would naturally ask is, are these, how are these phases distinct? And are they topological? And it turns out that indeed they are. So one could either compute the Chern number, or maybe more illustratively, one can just take a finite size system, like in finite size in real space, diagonalize it and look if there are edge states in the sample. And indeed, that's what one finds. So this is like this, the gap that corresponds to something like this. And at the one, at the top side, there is a mode coming down here. At the bottom edge, it's going down here. And for opposite sign of this parameter V2, these two reverses. Right? So these are now two opposite chiral states. And these are Majoranas. You can think about these. One is a P plus IP and one is a P minus IP superconductor. So one has a Majorana going clockwise and the other one has the Majorana going counterclockwise. So this is the kind of the simplest system where we can probably probe for the transition between these different phases, and turns out it's a good system to actually study thermal metal, which is what we mainly care about. Okay, so for getting a thermal metal, we need to add this order to the system. So we do that, we make both of these parameters random. And now I'm plotting again the system over here. The color coding is the conductance or the transmission probability to the system. So here it's zero, because we are in insulating phases. And in the middle, there is the gapless point over here. So we have one specific point where we do have a non-zero transmission through our sample. And as we crank up this order, nothing happens for a while. And then we get this kind of fan where we get a conducting state up here. This is not necessarily telling us all that much yet, because we don't know if it's really a thermal metal or if it's just some finite size broadened transition. So to understand if it's a metal, we actually need to see how does this large transmission that we find here depend on system size. And so that's what we indeed do. We take some point in this parameter space over here and just check the transmission probability or the conductance and how it depends on system size. And you can see it's reasonably well approximates this logarithmic growth. And even the slope is fairly close to this result from this RG, from this weak anti-localization. Of course, you can see that the conductance is not super large. So one might expect that it's not quite going to work perfectly, but we are controlled in the limit where inverse G is small and G is order one, but it actually works pretty well. And certainly the conductance grows with system size. And that's the behavior that we expect for thermal metal. So it seems like indeed we have a phase diagram where we have a localized phase, and here a thermal metal phase. So now another thing that we want to think about is what happens to the state at different energies, right? Because I argue to you that particle hole symmetry, which we need for anti-localization, is a property at zero energies. Let me take my disordered system over here, and at the same range of V, fix the disorder strength now, and plot it as a function of energy. And this is what we find. So down here, this line, that's the zero energy line, where we have localized phase, metal, localized phase. And now we can see that indeed this metal essentially dies instantly once I go to non-zero energies, right? So it's only really this kind of sliver in the middle. And as soon as I make my energy non-zero, I'm back to getting a localizing behavior like so. And these lines turn out to be not metals. That requires slightly more analysis. If we simulate the system with different system size, we find that this one here sharpens into phase transitions, but the conductance doesn't grow with system size as it would in the metal, but it's critical. And so these are not metallic states, but this kind of dark sliver here in the middle, that's where we have a thermal metal. So now we'll take the same data and see what happens as a function of energy, right? Like put in this direction. And again, I'm plotting the transmission probability now just as slices in this direction. And there are three regimes that we can see. Firstly, at the very smallest energies, here it's a log scale, so energies are very, very small. And here are different system sizes. And you can see that at the smallest energies, as I increase my system size, my conductance goes up. That's what I already showed you exactly for zero energy. So it holds for some small energy window shown over here. Then, as I go to higher energies, I get the opposite behavior. Now my conductance goes down as I increase my system size, which is the standard weak localization, which we discussed before and what we expect. And then eventually here, conductance becomes very small, which is certainly beyond the range where we should expect any RG to hold, but we still get localization. You know, the conductance becomes very, very small for all system sizes. And so this is the behavior. We have these two different type of scaling behavior in these regimes. And to understand the actual curve, we understand that in a finite system size, we have some kind of crossover. We perform the RG to a certain point, to a certain energy, say. Then we cross over from the anti-localization to the localization behavior. And then we keep running till the actual size of the system. So we follow at a fixed energy, we follow weak anti-localization for a while until the system realizes. Until the system realizes that it's not actually at zero energy and it's not supposed to be anti-localizing, and then this localizing behavior should kick in. But the actual thing to do is pretty simple. I'm defining this crossover scale, and I'm taking the value which I get from the conductance from the first form and just plugging it in as G naught in the second expression. And this should be a way to describe both kind of the entire range of the data as long as the RG holds, so for relatively large G. Okay, so that's what we have. We have these expressions over here, and we just see if these curves will collapse once I use this crossover form for the conductance. And you can see it works reasonably well. This is again exactly just the same data, just rescaled in such a way. You have one fitting parameter, which is LC, which we just choose to make it work well. And the dashed line, that's kind of the window, the corridor which you expect to hold based on the RG. But there's some specific slopes, it's 1/π or something. And yeah, it fits pretty well, and certainly it gets better and better once my system is larger and larger. So we think that this indeed tells us that all these curves really follow this crossover behavior as a function of energy, where this entire part is governed by this weak localization, anti-localization crossover. And over here, you can see that it fails miserably, right? It's completely off. And that's where the strong localization sits in, and we should no longer trust the RG expressions. And so we think that this model, which we wrote down, indeed has a thermal metal and actually reproduces the features of this perturbative RG calculation. And that's so now that we believe it works, we can use it to extract, for example, the localization lengths. So that's quite simple. We just use this formula for the conductance and say that the localization length is defined as a length scale where the conductance becomes order one. Right? So again, the RG assumes the conductance is large. Will it initially grow a bit more because of anti-localization, then it'll go down because of localization, and once it's one, that's what we call the localization length, and we get this kind of somewhat complicated expression. The key part is that in the exponent here, you have a log squared. So it's a very strong energy dependence, which actually dominates over any power law. So you can, in principle, even forget about this leading power, if you like. In a very small energy, this exponent here dominates everything, and you have a localization length that becomes very, very large at small energies. Right? Very, very large, meaning that your system is very close to actually being metallic.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
A very basic question. What did you mean by energy dependent conductance?
Okay, good. So when I call you the conductance, should really have said transmission probability. So what I'm talking about is for any energy, I can ask what is the probability of transmitting something at this energy. So that's a precise statement.
Uh-huh. But did you also analyze the real physical conductance as a function of temperature?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's so good. So now that we understand all this energy dependence, now we can, so this was, if you want just sanity checks, on that indeed we get the right behavior. And now what we actually care about is how do things depend on temperature? And in particular, we also care about what happens about the Hall conductance. Because so far everything, the RG tells us mostly things about the longitudinal conductance. And we have this intuition that if longitudinal conductance is small, Hall conductance we quantize, but it'd be nice to check whether this is indeed the case, since there are other aspects where this behavior was somewhat counterintuitive. So now we indeed want to compute a more honest temperature dependence. And for that, we just use Landauer formula for computing thermal conductance. So this is the formula. It's a little bit cumbersome, but it's not very complicated, right? It's just, you have your currents, you have an integral over all possible states. If you have Fermi function, you have this matrix here, which encodes transmission and reflection, transmission between different terminals and reflection. And then you have all the temperatures at these different terminals. Right? So you might be familiar with a similar equation for charge transport, which is actually exactly the same. You just replace this number here, this energy and the derivative of the Fermi function by temperature, by instead the charge and derivative of the Fermi function by chemical potential. And on the right-hand side, again, you replace temperature by chemical potential. So you just make this replacement and you get the familiar Landauer formula. Okay, so that's what we analyze. And this function here, this is the only part where temperature really enters, right? This is the important bit. And it enters through this kind of function over here. And you can see it's actually very strongly peaked around, this is a function of energy, and it's slowly peaked, it's strongly peaked around temperature, which means that at least, approximately, we could have just called the transmission probability at a given energy, the conductance at the certain temperature. It's a pretty good approximation. But of course, we don't need to do that. We can just compute it. So this is this big object over here. And we define the Hall conductance as just the temperature difference across the sample divided by the heat current, and the longitudinal resistance as the temperature drop parallel to the direction of the current.
Sorry, David, a very uneducated question. Why can't you just do four terminal?
Four terminal?
Yeah.
So how are you going to get, so you say which ones do you want to omit, I guess is the question.
I mean, maybe this is too naive, but isn't this standard four terminal measurement enough to give you all the conductivity tensor?
So there are ways of extracting it. It requires actually a lot of converting the data and lots of inversions. But the simplest way of thinking about it is, if I want to have longitudinal conductance, I need to have a way of measuring current, measuring the voltage drop along the direction of my current, right? So I need two terminals just to get my current, and then I do my voltage, kind of the voltage drop over here. So I would need all these four terminals, 1, 2, 3, 4, just for an honest measurement of longitudinal resistance. But then I need another terminal to actually get from, say, 3 to 5. And so what you can do, of course, is if you have just four terminals, you can change where you put the current and where you actually measure voltage. Mm-hmm. And so then if I had four terminals, I could then maybe put my current over here and then measure the voltage there and so on. So that you can play this game, but then you really need to be careful about not getting geometric effects, because then you may be not exactly parallel in the way that you put your currents. So you need to do a lot of manipulations in order to try to extract the proper values. So the cleanest way is just to do precisely this.
Okay, I see. Okay, thank you.
To make sure about this discussion, do you mean you need at least five terminals?
Yeah, so five terminals would definitely be enough. There's always a little bit of worry if you start to make it non-symmetric that you get some geometric effects.
Uh-huh.
Right. So in practice, what we actually do is we even symmetrize the Hall conductance by taking this one and this one over here. That doesn't make a huge difference. At some point, we had five terminals, but the fifth terminal was, for some stupid mistake of ours, not down here, but a little bit shifted to the side. And then we got all kind of strange data, not completely off, but a little bit strange, which was precisely because a little bit of longitudinal was added into the what we would like to call transverse. So the best way is to really have everything as symmetric as possible, so that what you think about as transverse is truly transverse.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so that's the general formula. And what we really do in practice is compute this big matrix, it's a scattering matrix, we compute this matrix numerically for fairly large systems, then we solve this equation. So for each realization, we then solve this set of equations to determine the Hall resistance and the longitudinal resistance. Then we determine the conductance tensor by inverting this matrix over here. We make it dimensionless. And finally, we disorder average the whole thing. And, so there's, and it's using this this package of numerical libraries called Quant, which has many, many things built in. So that allows us, we're doing typically a couple of hundred realizations for systems that are about 80 by 160 unit cells. So they're pretty big systems, you know, if you have to take into account all these terminals. Okay, and so that's, after all this long background, that's the data which I was showing you before. So let me again tell you what I'm seeing here. Firstly, the solid objects are at zero temperature. At zero temperature, I'm in a localized phase. There's no longitudinal conductance. Then at some point, I start to get metallic. I'm getting a fairly large value of the conductance. And if you were to make the systems bigger, this number would even increase. And you can see it's fairly noisy. And then it gets down, and I'm getting back to a localized phase where the conductance drops to zero. And at the same time, the Hall conductance, it's 1/2. That's a quantized value given by the Chern number. We knew that from the clean system. Then it does something unclear, right? It's eventually it gets back up kind of smoothly. There's certainly no plateau over here. And eventually it reaches the value of 1/2 for the second insulating phase. That's if you would, if you like, that's the behavior of the terminal metal. A terminal metal where kappa xy is not quantized and kappa xx is large. And now we do exactly take the same type of system, but we do this analysis at finer temperature, right? Same data, same disorder, same everything. Just analyze at finer temperature. And now you can see it behaves completely different. First, the longitudinal conductance, it goes up, it reaches some value, and then it goes down. And now we have what looks like a plateau where the conductance is very, very small. Then it goes up again and goes down again. So it looks like we have a topological phase transition here from one insulating phase to a second insulating phase to a third insulating phase. And at the same time, the Hall conductance, which is 1/2 over here, has a nice kind of flat intermediate region where it has a plateau at value zero. Now you may worry to what extent one should really call the zero value a plateau. And I sympathize with that, but that depends on the kind of system which you think you're modeling. For example, in the quantum Hall context, this zero would actually correspond to the particle Hall symmetric value, which is 5/2, which is the value of interest. That's essentially a matter of how do you physically interpret what this model really describes. So in the specific model, you get the plateau at zero. And that's certainly the surprising behavior. You raise temperature, you decrease the conductance in this region, and you get an emergent plateau where you otherwise would have had a terminal metal. Right? So even though the system is truly its ground state instead of a terminal metal, a finer temperature measurement of this type will actually give you a quantized value, and you might think that you have found topological phase. So this is what you can. This is again taking the same type of data, just now different kind of cuts. So I fix the value of this parameter V2, which is the one down here, and see how it depends on temperature. And you can see that as I increase temperature, even values that are initially quite strongly different converge to this. This nice quantized value over here. So that's the sharpening of the plateau with increasing temperature. Okay, so I'm guessing, I'm already out of time, so I'll wrap things up with the one caveat about this, which is I've completely neglected dephasing. There are certainly no phonons, no directions, mainly because that's not something where one can actually perform large-scale simulations, right? These kind of numerics are only possible because they're done in free fermion models. So we should at least think about what would dephasing do to these models and which parts of this phenomena would actually hold. So as before, the dephasing, there's some time, it's going to be a power law. You know, apparently in metals, people typically measure this power law as exponent between 1 and 2. You know, that's whatever it is. It's again not super important because it's just some power law. So we have three length scales in the game. We have the diffusion length, which I introduced before, which is where the system crosses over between anti-localization and localization. We have the localization length, which we determined from the RG. And we have the phasing length, which is some power, you know, for example, one or two. And now we can see how do these scales behave as temperature. So if I just naively plot these, you know, set all coefficients to one, just plot it, then at large temperature, I find that the dephasing length is the shortest of them. And that kind of seems very natural. You know, at high temperatures, I have a lot of interactions, very little quantum mechanical effects. So before I reach any of these crossover scales, I'll actually stop my quantum corrections. So I will get anti-localization, but I will not get much of it because the dephasing length is so short that I'm only renormalizing with some very short distance. So it's essentially a classical state, even though formally it's very, very weakly anti-localizing. But then as I decrease my temperature further, you can see that the dephasing length starts increasing, but the other two length scales, the localization lengths and this crossover length scale, remain smaller. And specifically, the important one to compare is the dephasing length compared to the localization length. Because if my system is already so well localized, by the time I lose quantum effects, it doesn't quite matter that I lose them eventually. My particles anyway never make trajectories big enough that they would ever notice this dephasing. So in such a regime over here, I would get this behavior which we found for the free fermion model, namely that temperature suppresses kappa xy and enhances the Hall conductance partition. But then at the very low temperatures, this exponent here kicks in, which dominates over any power law. And that's why it doesn't quite matter what the power law is. No matter what the power law I put here, eventually at the very low temperatures, this exponent here is going to be dominant. And the localization length, here the purple line, is going to be the largest length scale. And if that's the case, then the system dephases, it loses all quantum effects before it manages to localize, and that's what the thermal metal phase is. So these interaction effects make the thermal metal survive over some finite window of temperature. So that's just what it is, that's what temperature does. Essentially, you can always think about dephasing as a system, you know, having a very small but finite size. So dephasing is a little bit like what you do in numerics. You anyway study finite size systems where the RG kind of cuts off. So this would be nice, but it depends a little bit on how exactly you do it. So, you know, the main caveat here is all these expressions are supposed to be asymptotic expressions for low temperatures. So we actually have no business comparing these scales at higher temperatures. Now they probably work to some extent, but there may be completely different behavior kicking in at higher temperatures, or at the very least, I can change the exponent over here. For example, I can just increase the strength of whatever gives me the phasing by a factor 2, by making the phasing length just a factor of half larger. And I can see in this particular case, I completely lose this intermediate regime where I have localization and an enhancement of kappa xy. So the temperature enhancement only works for interactions within quasi-particles or with phonons which are sufficiently weak. And we don't exactly know what weak means. It seems to be that, you know, there's some number of order one, when you need to be smaller than that number in order to get this regime.
David, can I ask a question? Yeah. So back one slide, actually further back. This one. So in this case, now if I take into that defacing effect, is the crossover from the thermal metal to a localization still a crossover, or does it ever become a sharp transition at infinite system size?
I mean, that's the question, what you precisely mean by that. You can think about, you know, what is the conductance of my system? Conductivity, and it's given by, it's going to be exponentially small in L phi over C. So it's always going to be finite, but it's going to be exponentially small in this regime.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's But that's of course always the case, you know, when we think about any kind of localized states, you know, you have some localization effect, you have the phasing. So typically, you know, all your insulators will tend to have some non-zero conductance, which just can be very small. So in that sense, it's kind of comparable. It's the same quality of, you know, if the difference between these two phases is large enough, it's about the same quality of insulator as any disordered insulator you can ever have.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so I think I'm way over time anyway, so I'm about to wrap up right now. So based on what we found in these numerics and our deep statement, is we would kind of take this kind of generic phase diagram and try and draw it like this. If I'm in a thermal metal and I increase temperature, there are going to be some interactions in this thermal metal. This thermal metal is going to have some finite extent. So it's going to extend some over here. Then we move over and we actually may enter, if interactions are weak enough, a new localized phase. And if I'm somewhere in this region over here, kind of close to towards this, I may get any value of the Hall conductance. In particular, I may get this value of 5/2, even though the true ground state of the system is a delocalized state where there's nothing quantized. But if I were to measure it over here at finite temperature, I would measure a quantized value, which is of course consistent with what the experiment finds, right? And in fact, in the experiment, if you look at it, you can see that it works best. The quantization is best at high temperatures, and it goes kind of, you lose the quantization as you go to lower temperatures, and you deviate from the value which you're supposed to be getting. So, you know, it would be nice to declare success, but of course there are different reasons why this can happen. And in particular, the details of the experiment start entering here, you know, which is not a true kind of many terminal transport measurement, but you have these edge states which you use, and it turns out that there are different ways how you can also try to explain the data, which predict a similar upturn in the thermal conductance and the loss of quantization. So in that sense, we both seem to be consistent with the data, but our main point is not, we don't want to say that thermal metal is necessarily there. It's just the hope was that we could actually rule out the thermal metal because, you know, we don't like the thermal metal. It's nothing topological. You can't braid anything or something like that. But it may be difficult to do so because it seems that even given what we have, measurement of quantized values and so on, the true ground state of the system may actually not even be localized and that thus not topological at all. Okay, so let me just make a quick comment on this other candidate material where we also have this quantization. So there we have a better understanding of what the non-abelian phase would look like in a clean limit, which seems nice. But there, all the data that's been taken is at pretty high temperatures. So you can see that the typical temperature scales where anything appears to happen are, you know, maybe 7 Kelvin. That's the natural energy scale. And all the data is only down to 3.7 Kelvin. So it's all pretty high temperature data. So that is still, the kind of temperatures where you might expect to get a quantized value also if the ground state is a thermal metal. So we can't rule quite out there. So so from experimental perspective, you probably need to study the temperature dependence more systematically in order to really see is it truly a topological phase that's going on there, or can it be instead this thermal metal? So that's maybe a task for experimentalists. For theorists, I think it would be good to understand this notion of dephasing a little bit better. As I mentioned, it's a little bit murky, but there may be a chance that it's actually a little bit better for these emergent phases, simply because you don't have Coulomb interactions to mess things up. But both the Majorana quasi-particles in the quantum Hall context and the Majorana quasi-particles in the spin-liquid context are neutral, exponentially good. So dephasing may be slightly easier to cleaner to obtain. So that's maybe a task for theorists to get to understand the phasing mechanism and maybe thereby determine whether these data are actually consistent with topological phase. But a different perspective is one can say, well, maybe that's not even an important question. So if the thermal metal can exhibit this quantized value of the Hall conductance in the measurements we care about, maybe it can also exhibit other properties of topological phases, maybe interference or maybe even braiding. So the idea would be that only particles at zero energy can kind of diffuse into my system, and particles at slightly higher energy are stuck to the edge because the system is localizing at higher energies. And it may be that I can actually use say an interference measurement at finite temperature, even if the ground state is a thermal metal, to get exactly the same behavior as I would have got in a true topological phase. But this is an open question, I think. Okay, I think I'm way over time, so thank you all for listening.
Thanks, David. And thanks for everyone who managed to stay. Surprising to see that more than half of you did. So any more questions? Actually, David, I had a question. So do you have any comment on this recent numerical work by Zalatau, Simons, and Razai on the fact that disorder energetically doesn't seem to be producing, essentially that phase diagram we all like? The exact statement is the domain walls between Fafian and anti-Fafian seems to be too energetically costly.
But if I'm not mistaken, it's a statement about specific wave functions, right? I may be off on this right now, since I think that's what they kind of do. So I'm not exactly sure that that's necessarily a statement. I mean, it's very difficult, of course, to make a truly disordered study of an interacting system. But I think if I'm not wrong, they actually compare kind of specific wave functions for these phases and then see what happens to the domain wall. And you may argue that the true wave function in such disordered system may actually be quite different and thereby change the domain wall energetics quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. So they may well be right. I mean, these are smart people, they know what they're doing, but at least I had the impression that it was a little bit tied to very specific, to assuming a specific kind of state, at least in some length scale.
Okay. More questions before we end?
One question. When you add disorder, did you include the case where the flux is non-zero?
Yeah, so this is going to be there. So we typically take this order to be quite large, and we don't make any constraints on anything. So naturally, if I'm allowing my things to fluctuate quite big, I will generate configurations where you get the flux. And I think that's probably even required to get the thermal metal in the first place.
Yes.
Quite the canonical case, because in the canonical case, you have a transition where you go from, say, 0 to 1/2. Here you go from minus 1/2 to 1/2, so it's twice that. I don't know exactly what the condition there is, but I assume they would still hold.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Actually, one last question before we dismiss. So is there anything other than class D that shows this kind of behavior, that you only have localized anti-localization at exactly one energy?
I think that's true. I think you have, that's for specific energies, it's true. I mean, you have a similar crossover, of course, if you go between anti-localizing and localizing classes in a magnetic field. But mm-hmm. there you have different stories. In principle, of course, the only having an anti-localizing state at a given energy happens at the quantum Hall plateau transition.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But in such case, you also have in 1D. But I think if you actually want to have a metallic phase, I think it only that instantly dies. I think that's only in class D.
Yeah, I see. Okay. So let's thank David again. And thank you all for coming.
Thank you, John.